PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Well, hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. And our main focus for this program is narcissism. Some people have a misconception about narcissism. It's not what you think it is. It's not ego. It's not self-love. Yeah, it's self-loathing, envy, insecurity, self-destruction often. And to help us unravel this narcissism and closely related behaviors and diagnoses is my guest, Ross Rosenberg. Welcome to the program, Ross.
It's so nice to be back on again.
Yeah, it's been a couple, 3 years, and I so appreciated your book, which you promptly sent to me before our first program in 2013. And so let me tell our listeners again just a little bit about you. You're a psychotherapist and owner of Advanced Clinical Trainers and Clinical Care Consultants, and you're in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. You're considered an international expert in narcissistic personality disorder, codependency, trauma, self-addiction, and then you have a YouTube channel, and you've got, and it's really good. I've peeked at it. It features 80 of your instructional videos. And it's been viewed, get this, listeners, 3.9 million times. And you have over 35,000 subscribers. Good going, Ross. You're really creating a following.
Well, I was pretty unpopular in grade school and high school. I'm sometimes amazed myself because my goal is to let people know about this important stuff. And maybe to sell a few books, but I never could have anticipated how many people need to know about narcissism and codependency and trauma and addiction.
And clearly it resonated for lots of people. Your best-selling book, the one I'm looking at, The Human Magnet Syndrome, the subtitle is very good, Why We Love People Who Hurt Us. And this has sold already 30,000 copies. And you're in the process of being published in Spanish and French, and no doubt there'll be other languages to follow. And your second book, we're going to talk a little bit about both books. Mm-hmm. It's coming out probably next year, beginning of next year, Ross?
No. I wish. I'm estimating. I'm still working to. Negotiating with some publishers, but I'm thinking maybe a year to a year and a half it'll be available.
Okay, but meantime you're doing seminars based on the codependency cure, recovering from self-love deficit disorder.
Yes.
Let's give us an overview of your new book. You sent me some materials about it, and I think they're very interesting.
I spent about 3 years traveling around the United States and actually the world, giving trainings on the human magnet syndrome. And people kept asking me, "This is great, thank you, but so what do we do?" And I kept saying, "Well, let's talk about what the problem is, because it doesn't matter if I told you what to do, if you don't know what we're dealing with, there's no way that you'll ever get better. And then eventually I'm going to write a book and tell you what to do." So The Human Magnet Syndrome is my why book, and the book that I'm working on now is my how-to book. And codependency cure, it as much as The Human Magnet Syndrome reinvents and redefines codependency, the codependency cure takes the next step and explains codependency as a problem of self-love deficit. It is a problem that because you never learn to love yourself, never learn to have self-esteem, you automatically gravitate towards people who treat you badly, the narcissist, and you don't have the psychological abilities to break free. And so all of my work now is to help people understand that not only is codependency really a disorder of lack of self-love, but it goes all the way back to the trauma you experienced as a kid being raised by a narcissist. And if you can't resolve that trauma, which was the beginning point of your codependency, then you're going to be running on a hamster wheel for the rest of your life. And that's why this book is going to change everything, because it redefines codependency and it teaches people how to solve it and what resources and tools are needed to solve it.
Well, I haven't read your new book yet, obviously, but the Human Magnet Syndrome is beautifully written. Kudos to you on that. And
Thank you.
So many, you make things very clear. People need that. So we want to talk a little bit more about the narcissistic personality disorder and in your book, The Human Magnet Syndrome. But by the way, before I go any further, let's get the best website for people, and I'll put it in my summary after the show for you, because gave me a whole bunch of links. But what's the best one?
The best website is humanmagnetsyndrome.com.
That's what I thought.
And if you need an audio version or a Kindle version, go to Amazon. But go to humanmagnetsyndrome.com. It'll link you to everything, including the seminars. So it's kind of a portal that will kind of connect you to like all of my work, so we don't have to give your listeners a bunch of different websites.
Right. Okay, that's very helpful. And then go directly to Amazon for the Kindle version or the audio version.
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, so on page 120 in your Human Magnet Syndrome, you have sort of an overview of the narcissistic personality disorder and some of the five or more of the following, starting with a grandiose sense of self-importance. Do you want to expand on that and maybe some of the others?
Sure. I don't have the book in front of me, but since I wrote it, I think I'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I can prompt you if necessary, and then you can take it from there.
You know, it's funny because I was actually talking about this today in clinical supervision. I supervise therapists that work for my counseling center. One of the primary features of narcissistic personality disorder, or what I call pathological narcissism, is grandiosity. And what that means is they think they are more than they really are. They think they are bigger than they are, smarter, more handsome. They have this distorted sense of importance, and it's not that they're showing off. They believe that they're superior, and people should see it, and people should want to see it. And unfortunately, around healthy people, and the Human Magnet Syndrome talks about this, people get around a grandiose narcissist, and they go, WTF. They go, what the heck? It's like, what is going on? This guy is like pompous, but it's the codependence. It's the people that react to the grandiosity, and they feel like it's important and big. So the grandiosity is almost a delusional sense of self-importance. It usually it goes hand in hand with entitlement, where you believe that you deserve special treatment, preferential treatment, where you not only think you are this person that is, you know, Donald Trump is a perfect example. You think that you are this person that has done all these great things, but only in your mind are these things real. But as a result of your grandiosity, you think other people should treat you better. Those two, I'll stop here until you ask me the next question, but those two are primary features of narcissistic personality disorder.
Yes, the grandiosity and the entitlement, and you add in your book that this person can be preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. You brought up Donald Trump's name, and I would seem he's in that field too.
Yeah, he is. Well, so if we go into narcissism, and then I'll transition to Trump. Is that there's entitlement, there's grandiosity, there's this fixation on yourself, whether you're mm-hmm. looking at yourself in the mirror, or you're taking selfies. Not that if you take a selfie, you're a narcissist.
No, of course not. Too many would be
email
if
me.
That was true.
And the whole world would be in trouble.
Yeah.
This preoccupation with yourself and this need for affirmation, this need for recognition, this need, what makes the narcissist even more troublesome, if you put it all together, the entitlement, the grandiosity, the self-centeredness, they are very fragile. And if you confront them, you criticize them, or just disagree with them, even in a friendly way, they have what we call a narcissistic injury. And we see that with Donald Trump. But everyone that knows someone who's a severe narcissist or has narcissistic personality disorder has experienced the wrath, whether it's passive-aggressive or direct. When you criticize a narcissist, they react as if you are trying to hurt them, destroy them, or break them, and they fight back with a ferocity.
Mm-hmm.
And they, whether they try to hurt you or they try to discredit you.
Mm-hmm.
So you take someone like Donald Trump, who's got all the grandiosity, the entitlement, the unrealistic perception of his importance, and when someone confronts him about being wrong, he not only blows up, and you don't see this on TV, but if you read articles about people that have been around him or you've seen some of his reality shows, he will berate and try to tear someone down, not because he's trying to do something good, but because it triggers in him this rage, which really, paradoxically, is about themselves. See, narcissists actually have deep, deep shame and self-hate,
yes,
and self-contempt.
Yes.
They just are not conscious about that. And so they project it. So if you criticize a narcissist and they react with a narcissistic injury and they try to hammer you or hurt you, it's because of their fragile nature that they can't handle it because of how broken they are inside. They push it back on you. But really, everything that they say to you that they dislike, it's about them. It's a projection. They are really talking about themselves, but they can't ever hear it. So if Donald Trump is confronted about someone, for example, yesterday, 50 people, prominent people, national defense people, generals, politicians, wrote an open letter basically saying that he's not fit to be the president and he would be the worst president in our history to represent us. Well, what he does is he... we don't know if he screamed or yelled, but what he does is he attacked them back and called them all, and I'm paraphrasing, a bunch of losers and a bunch of, you know, he tries to hurt the people as a way to defend them himself, and that makes him narcissistic.
I'm thinking that I don't know too much about his family of origin, but I'm guessing that he had a pretty narcissistic parent, at least his father, and maybe his mother, because a lot of kids who grow up with narcissistic parents will they begin to realize, especially in therapy, that they may have existed only as reflections of a mother or a father, and so. In other words, the parent says, "What do you mean? It's your own life."
I mean, and I actually write this in my Human Matter Syndrome, where I talk about how someone becomes both a codependent or a narcissist. I can say this with almost 100% certainty to anyone that has a narcissistic personality disorder: if you were able to get the accurate history of their childhood, which you're not going to get from the narcissist. One is they won't remember. And that's a whole complicated reason for why they don't remember it. Can explain maybe another time or later if we have time. And if they do remember, they don't talk about it because they're too. They have such a grandiose, entitled picture of themselves that they try to show the whole world. But every narcissist that I've known can be traced back to having severe to have a narcissistic parent who severely neglected or abused them, or did not attach with them during their childhood.
Right.
Every narcissist, they are created because of their own trauma as a child.
Their own trauma.
So, yes.
And so if we look at attachment theory, typically it's broken down into secure attachment, which is the best, or anxious or avoidant attachment. And so I think that parents did neglect, and so that's avoidant. And then if the kid spoke up, you called it a narcissistic, I call it a wound. You said injury. It's the same kind of thing.
Well, actually, they're different.
Set me correct.
So you're talking about what happens to the person that the narcissist. They get wounded, they get hurt, and those wounds are instrumental in determining what type of person they're going to be as they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
The narcissistic injury is a term that explains why, if you confront a narcissist, you criticize a narcissist, you give them constructive feedback, they get so angry and they want to hurt you or attack you or try to punish you. It's you're injuring them, their fragile ego, and they can't handle it, so they have to make you feel bad or hurt you.
And yes, all of that is true. And also, the narcissist typically lacks empathy and compassion.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a central feature.
Yes.
If you are so wounded because you did not attach with a parent and you were so shut down psychologically, you grow up, you survive by only focusing on your own needs. It's kind of paradoxical. The child who comes from narcissistic parents who did not attach because of, you know, their own narcissism,
right,
they survived by knowing that no one's going to ever love them, and the only person that loves them is and that will take care of them is themselves. So the very childhood that tore down the healthy walls of psychological development created this coping mechanism is to dismiss everyone else to only take care of yourself. That's a very good explanation,
Ross. I don't think I've read it exactly that way, and I've not heard it, but that absolutely makes sense.
And so a person who grows up in an environment who decides that, you know, everyone's for themselves and they got to take care of themselves, it precludes, it inhibits, it puts a damper on the development of empathy. Because empathy, we learn through the experience of someone being empathetic with us. The child who's attached, who's got a mother and father who's empathetic, often learns, well, this is what people do, and it's modeled to them. But without any empathy ever in your life, the narcissist grows up not developing that early during a critical stage of development, so they don't have that as an adult.
You know, in the 33 years I've been a psychotherapist, Dana, board-certified sex therapist, of course, I've heard many, many histories, and I use a number of approaches as a therapist, but I think it's valuable to use attachment theory, because if you look at adult relationships through the lens of attachment theory, you can see that what we most want is somebody who is responsive, available, first of all, to us, and then responsive. And I was really a fortunate girl because my parents gave me secure attachment, and they were affectionate with each other and with myself and my siblings. And, you know, I just know how lucky I was. I didn't have to take abnormal psych 101 in college to figure out, well, how come I'm so fucked up, you know, that I didn't have to do that. And consequently, when I'm a therapist, I can model good, healthy behaviors even more effectively because it's really a part of who I am. So I know I'm lucky. I know I am. Most people are not so lucky.
No, especially people in the psychotherapy field. And
yeah,
you are fortunate because as much as we talked about the origins of narcissism and why someone's empathy never gets developed and why they build this wall around themselves and to protect themselves while trying to be destructive of others, the person who comes from a narcissistic parent who learns that the only way that they can get love is by sacrificing themselves, becoming invisible, being the friend of the narcissist who doesn't really take care of them, they develop what I call in my book a relationship template, and they learn that love, you are loved, you are lovable when you take care of everyone else and you sacrifice your own needs.
Exactly.
And that template is just like the narcissist, their template of no one cares about you, so it's all about me, I'm going to take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
That template was born out of trying to survive in their childhood. The child
right.
who's to be codependent actually figured out a way to get love, conditional love. And they
conditional
got it.
Love.
They got it, but it was at a sacrifice. So there was the model for them that when you sacrifice and become invisible and you don't complain, you people will love you and take care of you. And that goes back to attachment theory also.
Yes,
most, many therapists actually start there, because who's going to go into a field that where you have to listen to everyone's problems and take care of people? Well, people that want to help and heal others. Thank God for that.
Mm-hmm. But then the problem
and then, of course, a lot of therapists end up going to therapy, and they deal with their codependency and become healthier.
That's right. And if the therapist hasn't done that, they're going to take in too much of the client's problems, and they can't be as objective, in my experience. Because at the end of the day, you have to go home and brush the cooties off. You have to be certain of who you are, and I think you're a more effective helper. And you've done the work. You've done the work.
I come from a dysfunctional family with a narcissistic father and a severely codependent mother who are both deceased. But and I was married to two pretty severe, what I believe were pathological narcissists.
Yes.
My attorney always told me to say what I believe, and apparently. And then because of the agony of these relationships, and I decided to go into therapy and to stop it and to end this pattern. I didn't want to have my third wife be another narcissist, and it was through that process and my motivation to figure out what was behind it all, and my healing is that resulted from it, came the ideas of the book.
Yeah, Harville Hendricks, who's quite well known in our field, he gives a blurb on the back cover of your book. He says, born in the cauldron of personal experience of suffering and healing and honed through years of professional experience, this book will help anyone understand the attractors of love and consequent suffering. I recommend it to couples who are mystified by the depth and repetition of their pain and joy, and to therapists whose destiny is to help them. I have recommended your book to a number of my clients, and they have praised your book and said how helpful it has been.
And I never get tired of hearing that, because I dream. When I was a kid, then when I grow up, I want to be a therapist that helps people and changes the world. I never could have imagined that it would be because of everything that has screwed up in my life and how I suffered and the therapy that I went through to bring me out of it to feel good about myself, that I would have created this book or these trainings or these videos. And so it makes me feel like I have a place in the world and that I'm helping out.
Well, you do, and you're also very smart, because you're using media, and that is the best way to get your message out to a whole lot of people. And it's one reason I've done this show for 6 years now, and before that, when I lived in Hawaii, I did another show that was in an actual radio station for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it only reached all the Hawaiian Islands, but still.
but what a lovely place to reach.
Oh, yes, and especially since I often do focus on sexuality. And, oh, boy, sex and paradise, you can't beat it.
Right. Yeah, good combo.
Yeah, it's a good combo. So malignant narcissism, and you, well, first in your book you talk about covert narcissism and then malignant narcissism. Can you tell us the difference between the two?
It's interesting that there's such a thirst for explanations. I have on YouTube, I have two videos on covert narcissism, and just those two videos by themselves are about 450,000 views.
Mm-hmm.
And and I also have a videos on malignant narcissism. But covert narcissism is the one that scares the people the most, because these are the narcissists that pretend to be lovers, healers, people who are altruistic. They pretend sometimes to be codependent. They have this facade of kindness and generosity that helps them get what they need in life, which is whether money, attention, praise, you know, all the narcissistic goodies. And beneath the facade is a calculated narcissist who actually understands, and this is why the covert narcissists are so scary, they actually understand that if they act the way that they feel, they won't be able to keep the job or the rewards that come from their covert narcissism. And so when I started talking about this, people started, you know, having these like moments of, oh my God, it's like that explains, you know, my rabbi, my priest, the politician, my best friend, you know, the person who like everyone thinks is so sweet and so nice, but behind the scenes, when they're not in front of their public that feeds them, they are nasty narcissists.
And you write in your book, they are secretly selfish, calculating, controlling, angry, and vindictive.
The video that I just did its title is "If You Unmask a Covert Narcissist, Run, and Run Quickly." And I'm saying something that no one else has ever said. I'm basically saying, don't mess with these people because they're going to kick your ass. Because you are battling with people that understand how much is at risk for the truth to come out. They are conscious of their narcissism, whereas your Donald Trumps of the world, they don't think there's anything wrong with them. They think it's you.
Yes, so if you big difference.
Are
you familiar, Ross, are you familiar with Dr. Drew Pinsky's book, The Mirror Effect, How Celebrity Narcissism is Seducing America? I think in 2009, but The Mirror Effect, he describes just very briefly, the mirror effect is a tendency to obsess over those damaging celebrity stories and mirror them back in our own behaviors. So there is this temptation to solve all problems the way celebrities do, through body image obsession, sexual acting out, drug use, and diva behavior. So all of this is really a threat to our relationships, our families, our mental health, and our safety. That he takes it the extra step by focusing in on these celebrities.
Right. Yeah, and celebrities, I work with celebrities. I have a few as my clients, and they come from the same background, the same explanations that explain a narcissist or a codependent apply to them, but the celebrities, narcissistic celebrities, they are able to get the attention. Because of their skills and their gifts, they're able to be on stage and make a career out of it. And that makes them worse, because a lot of narcissists can't really pull it off. They trip over their own narcissism, that there's consequences of their narcissism. They tend to get fired a lot. They tend to have a lot of broken relationships. People don't like them. And they're secretly walking around in a spiral of shame. But if you're a celebrity and mm-hmm. you have a narcissistic personality disorder and you're selling millions of albums,
yep.
hundreds of thousands, you have evidence in your own mind that there's nothing wrong with you. And so that is why, and the public seems to love that. There's something, there's a symbiotic relationship between the public and these pathological narcissist celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
We just
yeah, and I suppose that also reflects the huge growth of reality television shows.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. Absolutely.
I mean, starting with the Kardashians, and they started years ago, and there have been all of these others. And I heard Kelly Ripa this morning on her show, Kelly Live, say that her daughter was in Los Angeles, her 15-year-old daughter was in Los Angeles with her husband, who's doing a television show there in L.A., and, of course, Kelly Ripa is in New York City. But her daughter said, I want to move here, and I want to meet the Kardashians. And see, she's already getting sucked in. Do this.
That's funny.
And, you know, the Kardashians are famous for nothing other than being famous.
Right? Actually, they tapped into the they tapped into it. It's funny because this might sound like I'm veering off, but I'm really not. I watched the O.J. story that was on. It was a really good. It was a really good miniseries. But the father Kardashian, and I can't remember his name, Papa Kardashian.
he was the O.J. Simpson.
He was so codependent. Oh my gosh, he was so codependent.
Interesting.
And it showed. I mean, the storyline.
Robert, that was his name, Robert.
Robert, he took the whole O.J. thing all the way to my fishing analogy is just sinker, hook, line, something.
Mm-hmm.
Hook, line, and sinker. And so if you think about the human magnet syndrome, codependents are magnetically attracted to narcissists and narcissist codependents. So if we have evidence on this TV show of how incredibly codependent he was, then the mother Kardashian had to be incredibly narcissistic.
And she seems to be.
She has to be. Because
yeah.
it's always
I mean,
way.
I've watched a few of the shows. It's in fact,
be.
They all act... All of the daughters act really narcissistic, so self-absorbed. It's all about me. It's all about me. All about the material things I can get, and I've got all this money, and on and on and on.
Exactly. And so here you have an example of, to your point, that these reality shows, there's a symbiotic connection between the public, who just loves to be a voyeur and look into mm-hmm. these lives of these rich and crazy narcissists.
Yeah.
It's good entertainment.
mm-hmm.
But not, and there's even an explanation because mm-hmm. we are feeding them crack cocaine dosages of attention. We're talking about narcissists who are not only getting paid for it, but are getting paid a lot of money.
Right. That is true. I mean, apparently every single one of the Kardashians are now multimillionaires. So, well, let's move over to malignant narcissism. And as I read your description in your book, the wonderful book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, Why We Love People Who Hurt Us, mm-hmm. Emotional Manipulators, Codependence, and Dysfunctional Relationships. So as I read your description of malignant narcissism, many aspects of it did seem to describe Donald Trump.
So, you know, people are like, there's so many people. I've even had people write me. I had someone from the Bernie Sanders campaign contact me, and they said they wanted me to write an article on the Bernie Sanders this and that about Trump being a malignant narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, he's not. And they got all, like, upset. He is. He has to be.
So how do you discern
I'll
the difference?
I'll explain why he's not. Mm-hmm. And first of all, Trump is a dangerous guy, and we don't want him as president.
I would agree with
okay.
that.
Okay, so I'm all for believing that we have to do everything we can to keep him from being president. A malignant narcissist is a unique combination of a psychopath or someone with a sociopath, paranoid personality disorder, as we used to call it, and narcissistic personality disorder. Mm-hmm. They are severely paranoid, they are severely narcissistic, and they do not have empathy when they hurt people. So psychopaths, so when you put these three together, you have a narcissist who needs people's affirmation, needs people's attention, wants to protect them. They have this belief that they are so important that they will protect people from greater harm. And typical malignant narcissists are like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Gaddafi. That these people rose up.
Saddam Hussein.
They rose up from the being poor and impoverished. And they were able to get all these people around them and to help them, to build them up, to help and fight and vanquish the what they called were the oppressors. Hitler did it. Stalin did it. And once they got into power, they had this huge following. They would do anything and everything to maintain that following, which included murder, rapes, imprisonment. So if we take the sociopathy part or psychopathy part of it, is the whether it was Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Hitler, whomever, they had no regret about killing people who they thought needed to be killed in order to protect their motherland, their fatherland. The raping and the pillaging, they were paranoid that they had that people were going to try to take over, so they had to implement. Rules to keep people from, a coup or a takeover. And the narcissism that they're so good and so perfect. The reason Donald Trump is not a malignant narcissist, and I'm sorry, because people really want to make this guy look bad, and he deserves it. He doesn't have the psychopathic, the sociopathic background. This is a guy that actually believes in his own delusion of grandeur. This guy does not have any history of murdering, killing, hurting, beating up people.
Right.
I mean, yeah, he might be a lousy husband or a lousy parent, which I don't know is true or not, but he doesn't have that psychopathy, that sociopathy. He doesn't have the paranoia. So I think that, if we play it out, and let's say, God forbid, he gets elected for president, he will be a horrible president, but he needs people to like him. He just invites people into his arena so that they can tell him how great he is. He doesn't feel malignant in that way, so he doesn't really fit the definition of malignant narcissism.
Okay, that's a good distinction, yes.
Now, the word malignant fits.
Yes.
He's malignant. That's a word. I'm not saying that's bad. But what we know about the term malignant narcissist is very specific. That includes the paranoid personality disorder, the antisocial personality disorder, and the narcissistic personality disorder.
And so you write about all
guys.
Of them.
Sorry, he's not a malignant narcissist, but, he's not.
Yeah.
I think.
Right. Right. So let's move, because this show is just under an hour long, and I'd like to talk a little bit about, we'll go from Donald Trump to actually people living with a narcissist. And because we have listeners, of course, who are living with one, and I like to point out that good relationships are based on reciprocity. You listen attentively and empathically to the other person's what joys and sorrows, for example, and then he or she listens to yours. And with narcissists, it's a one-way street. So naturally, a steady diet of this can be toxic to a person's sense of self.
Absolutely. And the only type of person that is attracted to them magnetically and consciously and reflexively is a codependent. And the reason that they don't leave them is written, I'm writing about it. It's also, you know, the codependency cure, by the way, for your listeners. Much of the material that's going to be in my new book is available in a video, a six-hour video, which you can get on the site that we mentioned earlier, the Human Magnet Syndrome site, in the training section.
Oh, that's so good.
As much as we talk about codependents and narcissists and we paint a picture of them, there is this attraction that feels so right. And so the people that stay with them, they don't have the self-love, they don't have the foundation to break free from the pain, the suffering, the insecurity, and the fear. And that holds them glued into the relationship with the narcissist like they're addicted. Any codependent that says they finally want to walk away from their narcissist and is not in therapy, they might get so mad one day that they'll say, fine, I'm done. But like when I tried to quit smoking years ago, and I haven't smoked since then, that those withdrawals come back, and codependency, just like a drug addiction, has withdrawals. You start thinking about things that don't really exist, like they love me or I love them or maybe they feel lonely. You start like making up stories that pulls you back to your drug of choice where you can feel comfortable and attached and dissociated in your codependent narcissist relationship.
It's familiar.
Absolutely.
It becomes familiar. And I have I have a rather scatological metaphor that, and going back to one's family of origin, so the room may smell like shit, but you're familiar with the smell. It's familiar, so you go back to it. The other thing about living with a narcissist is that a lot of times the person, the partner, the spouse, when he or she is a narcissist, you may be subjected to insults and admonishments for always doing something wrong and never measuring up, because belittling makes the narcissist feel bigger.
Well, I mean, what they learned is that the only person that is going to make them feel good is it has to be themselves. And so when they cut someone else down, it's projection. So if you think about all the things that narcissists don't like, when a narcissist doesn't like you, listen to what they say they don't like. And what you'll find out is what they don't like about themselves, but they're unconscious of it. They're unable to think about it. They don't like people because, and if you listen to the Trump or you listen to any other narcissist, they're talking about themselves. And it's eerie. It is so clear. This is the projection part. And that's how they feel good, is they have such a broken, fragile sense of self that never was formed as a child, that they could only feel better when they can make others make others feel bad, or they just can get other people to focus on how great they are.
And you know, I use the word belittling, but you break down belittle, it's be little.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when they make someone feel bad, they feel justified. They feel like they're doing the right thing. They're really perpetrating the very same thing that happened to them when they were a child. They are falling back into what they learned, that the only way that narcissists can ever feel good about themselves is somehow making the other person feel bad at their expense.
So let's talk about what a person can change. Now, I thought that was a very good distinction you made at the top of the program, that your first book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, was the sort of how-to, was the why. Your first book is the how-to, and then your second, your no, the first book is the why. Oh, I'm so sorry. Your new book, I made some notes. Your new book is the how-to, the one that hasn't come out yet. And the first book was the why. So, yes.
Or a better way of putting it, the Human Magnet Syndrome is the answer to the why. And my newest material that's available on YouTube and my six-hour seminar, the Codependency Cure, is the how-to. Where I finally tell people what they can do in order to reverse the patterns and define self-love, because self-love is the antidote to codependency.
Yeah, and I sometimes suggest to people that they use empathic confrontation, and this is where you can demonstrate that you appreciate how the other person feels while making an unambiguous statement of how you feel and what you need. So say your spouse comes home an hour after you were planning dinner again and says, so I'm late, okay, I'm tired, I don't want to hear any of your complaints, let's eat. And what that person should not say is, don't you dare talk to me that way.
Right.
What is probably better to say is, I know you're the boss at work, but I'm not one of your subordinates. Our relationship doesn't work that way. And I know you're exhausted, and I know you've had a tough day, but I'm allowed to be disappointed when you're late. It's been three times this week. Isn't that a better way to respond to a narcissist?
Well, first of all, it's a really good way to respond to people who are treating you unfairly. It's a very good instruction on setting boundaries while not antagonizing someone.
Mm-hmm.
But if you said that to someone who has a narcissistic personality disorder, it would antagonize them.
It absolutely would.
Because you can't say it nice enough. You cannot set a boundary and tell them to stop doing something because it's hurting you. You can't say that nice enough unless you just don't say it. And any way that you say it, that is direct, they will experience it as you are criticizing them or telling them there's something wrong. They hear, that's the narcissistic injury. They go to the injured place, and they feel bad, and they either will ignore it, which would be passive aggression, or overt aggression is they'll just say, well, you know, no, you don't, you know, and they'll ridicule you, belittle you, or whatever. So, yes, your advice is well articulated. It's just will not work on someone with a narcissistic personality disorder because they don't really care about you working hard also, unless somehow that helps them or makes them feel good.
Yeah, because most narcissists, it's a one-way street. It's not a two-way street. Right? And again, we're back to lack of empathy, I guess.
Absolutely. And there are degrees, and I write about this in my Human Magnet Syndrome book, there are degrees of narcissism, and there are degrees of this, you know, this pathological caretaking, which in extreme is codependency. So not every narcissist has a personality disorder. So on my continuum, if you are on the moderately narcissistic side, that advice would be perfect. It would be perfect. But if you have the personality disorder, you don't have the empathy, you're entitled, you're grandiose, you know.
Right.
And kind of, then it would fall on deaf ears.
So with a more benign condition of narcissism, then I think some couples can recognize that it can come down to a question of leverage, asking questions like, does your partner care enough to change the way he acts?
Right.
Will your partner respect reasonable limits on selfish, entitled, and inconsiderate behavior?
My question is, is your partner capable of it? Because what you're asking is for the person that doesn't have a personality disorder, where there is a real question. Well, maybe they can, maybe they won't, maybe they do. But if we're talking about someone with a personality disorder, a bona fide mental health diagnosis, they're not capable. And the covert narcissist, if they're in front of people, will act like, oh, yes, thank you. Thank you for the feedback. I really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And then once everyone is away, they will nail you. So the question is, if you're in a relationship with someone who is a pathological narcissist whose narcissism is at the level of a personality disorder, the question is, are they capable? And if they're not, everything you're doing will not have the impact that you hope it does. And if you're codependent, you will think it does, and you will stay in that relationship like a hamster in a hamster wheel. You'll go round and round and round, but never get anywhere.
So, Ross, do you mind sharing a little bit about your personal journey and how you managed to extract yourself from two marriages where your wives were fairly narcissistic or quite a lot narcissistic? What did you do?
Well, being a psychotherapist and being divorced twice, especially when the second time I was telling everyone that she's my soulmate and it was perfect, pure love.
Mm-hmm.
And having two wives who hurt me so badly, and because of their narcissism, at least what I believe was narcissism.
Yeah.
Of course, they wouldn't believe it. The humiliation and the self-loathing and the shame. I mean, I had to reconciliate. Who am I? How could I be this therapist who's helping people but have this personal life that's a wreck? And I finally hit my personal bottom, and I'll save you all the details. And I decided I was acting out and doing things that weren't healthy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I like a lot of codependents do. They're always... Mm-hmm. It's not just their codependency.
Mm-hmm.
I finally hit bottom, and I decided I was going to get some help, and I wasn't going to stop until I figured it out. And that's
wow.
where it began.
You were determined.
And then one day in a therapy session with a therapist in Northbrook, Illinois, Jill Mailing, she showed me this book by Alice Miller about, it's called The Dance of the Gifted, The Drama of the Gifted Child, and introduced the idea of why a child grows up becoming a codependent, although she didn't use the word codependent.
Thank you.
And it was then I realized I am the way I am because of what happened to me as a child. And so, short story long, it was through this understanding that I started to piece things together. And the more I learned about myself, the healthier I became, the more I was able to help my clients. And it became this kind of this train moving forward that the speed picked up, the more I was getting to places that I needed to get to. And I felt finally able to like love myself and care for myself. And then my choices and relationships started to change. The human magnet syndrome started to reflect my mental health. And
so you
I felt
more and more
people.
Empowered as you got more and more insight. So the book is The Drama of the Gifted Child, and you
By
no
Alice
doubt
Miller.
Were a gifted child.
And the word gifted means, and it's a kind of a twist, is to the narcissist, the child is a gift to them.
It's a reflection
of
them.
To a person who's not a narcissist, the child, we are gifts to the child. We do everything to make that child feel loved and cared for. But the child is for them, to make them feel good.
Right.
The child grows up knowing that they are nothing more than a gift, a trophy, to make their parent feel good. And if they don't behave in that way, they will not be loved anymore. And that's the drama of the gifted child.
And that is that the child exists only as a reflection of the narcissistic parent.
And that's the begin. That's ground zero for codependency.
Right. It's all well. Your book is brilliant. We're coming to the last few minutes of the program because Progressive Radio Network likes us to stop a few minutes before the top of the hour. And I think that I'm so glad that PRN archives these shows, because lots, and we'll make sure you get a link, so maybe you'll put it up.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Because you've done Jenny McCarthy's show. I love her. She's...
Yeah, she actually, Jenny has invited me three times on her show, and is a fan, and I'm happy about that, because I think she's great.
I do, too. I like her spirit, and she's a Chicago girl, too.
Oh, yeah, right? She is, yes.
Yeah.
She sure is.
And I bet she's fun. And have you gone into the studio?
She does her studio either in New York or in Chicago, or in the suburbs of Chicago where she lives, mm-hmm. and the studio's in her home. So
she's got a good gig, yeah.
Just come on in, the door's open. Just walk right
mm-hmm.
in there.
Yeah. So I was thinking, as we wrap this up, in their more common everyday form, narcissists simply embody the old line. You've heard this line. We've talked enough about me. Now let's talk about you. What do you think of me? I think I've seen that line in a parody a movie. Yeah. But there's no question that narcissists are maddening to people who have to deal with them in love or at work or even at play. And people can avoid picking narcissistic lovers if they learn to spot the signs, whether the narcissist in your life is your boss or a parent. Well, you don't have very much control there, but maybe you do. But you have to learn how to handle these people without going crazy yourself. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't think that learning how to pick a narcissist or to choose a healthy person ever works, and that's where my Codependency Cure stuff is going to help people. It's really about curing the trauma, resolving the trauma that draws you to people that hurt you. That's going to solve the problem.
Ross, I'm hearing the music, which means we have to wrap this up. Thank you so much. You've informed us and entertained us. Thank you. And I hope
welcome.
I can entice you back to this program in the near future.
And you sure will. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again. Bye, everybody.
Love it. Happy feet. Happy feet. Happy feet.